Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were saying, which was this idea that just as we nourish our bodies, we should also nourish our souls. And just as there are things that are a damage and can harm our bodies, there are also things that can harm and damage our souls. So we had said that things that nourish the body, of course, include, but are not limited to, praying and fasting and reading our salat and reading the Holy Quran, doing the du'as and the supplications and the different rituals and ceremonies and traditions that we have, the true, pure Islamic traditions. And we had also said that it is very important to do righteous actions and that these actions are also a nourishment for the soul. So we talked a little bit, dear friends, about those things which will help our soul to increase its aspect of ubudiyyah. But likewise, there are things and there are mixtures which can prevent our ubudiyyah and weaken our ubudiyyah. There are things which will weaken our soul and prevent it from conducting the worship of Allah. Now, naturally, this mixture which is harmful and will damage our soul and will weaken our ubudiyyah is prepared by Satan's filthy hands. But not only is Satan involved in this mixture of deadly poisons which will destroy our soul, there is the meddling of the obstinate self that only desires. It runs after carnal desires wildly like a wild animal. Now, these whisperings and these insinuations and this instigation of Satan, along with our self which wants to go after carnal desires like a wild animal, the two of these together give birth to nothing but satanic character. And when the heart and the soul get their nourishment from these two, that is, Satan's hands and the self which wants to go only for carnal desires, then this character becomes the image of the soul. But here, dear friends, we must remember that taking the step to stop committing acts which are a disobedience to Allah, this step is the first step, of course, in order to not go down this path. The more an individual sins and disobeys Allah, the easier it becomes for Satan to influence them, and the easier it becomes for them to fall prey to the instigations of the lower self. This lower self, which, like a wild animal, only desires carnal desires, money and wealth and power and physical relations and things like this. One must have the intention to not commit sin, and one must not commit sin. And eventually, in addition to those spiritual nourishments which brings us close to Allah, we will find that refraining from committing sins and refraining from doing things that damage our soul will help us to become closer to Allah, and it will help us to strengthen and improve our ubudiyyah. Otherwise, if a person decides to continue to put these negative aspects and these negative actions and these, you know, negative things into their soul and eat this kind of junk food for the soul, if you will, then slowly their character becomes satanic. They become a offspring of Satan, and they are eventually included among the shayateen min al-jinn wal-ins. The result, of course, is nothing but loss, regret, and at one point even repentance will avail to nothing. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As Israel's systematic attacks on Gaza and Al-Quds persist, another war continues to rage on in Europe. The battle pits pro-Palestine activists pushing a global anti-Israel boycott campaign versus local authorities who back ties with Israel. Founded in 2005, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, also known as BDS, is a Palestinian-led movement promoting economic sanctions on Israel. Due to the movement's popularity, Tel Aviv has lobbied European lawmakers to criminalize the group and its activities. France, Germany and Britain are key battlegrounds, but lesser known is the struggles of the BDS in Austria. Speaking to local members, a crackdown on BDS activism remains ongoing.
It started in 2018 when, for example, the local city government of Vienna, they implemented city resolutions, for example, against the BDS movement, where they say all local institutions and governmental institutions are not allowed anymore to support the movement, so which means all public places, they are restricted for us. And all these restrictions against the BDS movement in Austria, in Europe and worldwide, I think it's a reaction from the Zionist movement and from the Zionist lobby, because BDS is getting stronger and stronger.
The Vienna city government are currently suing a BDS Austria representative over a Facebook post showing an image plastered over an official city poster. Elsewhere, support for the BDS can get you labelled anti-Semitic due to Austria adopting the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
European authorities are introducing new legislation which aims to stop the activities of the peaceful boycott campaign. But policing people's desires not to invest in the Israeli regime is proving a near impossible task. Speaking to representatives of the BDS here in Vienna, they say that the response is an inevitable backlash to the group's success in undermining and damaging Israel's reputation across the continent. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu says he had a side talk with Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad on the sidelines of the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in October last year. The Turkish minister added he suggested a reconciliation to take a place between the Syrian government and the opposition, noting that without such a step, Syria will continue to face a crisis. Cavusoglu said that the EU and the international community would support a ceasefire in the war-torn country, and that no country would help in Syria's rebuild the process if a ceasefire is not achieved.
To prevent the division of Syria, there must be a strong administration in Syria. The will that can dominate every corner of its lands can only be achieved through unity and solidarity. We need to bring the opposition and government together for reconciliation. There will be no permanent peace otherwise.
Some believe such a revelation is a signal indicating Turkey is preparing for its cross-border military operation in northern Syria. In recent weeks, the Turkish army has been sending reinforcements to northern Syria, near the town of Tel Rifat. The town is under the control of Kurdish YPG forces, a U.S.-backed militia that Turkey considers the armed wing of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as PKK.
I think the timing of this announcement comes as Turkey's preparing for a cross-border military operation to secure the border area and push back Kurdish forces. A reconciliation between the government and the opposition will not only bring peace to Syria, but also Turkey, a country that has been directly affected by the Syrian war, from terrorist attacks to the refugee crisis.
Some analysts believe Turkey has long been serving its own agenda in Syria. For example, by supporting some opposition groups inside Syria who served Ankara's interest in securing its borders and pushing Kurdish forces back. It might be soon to say whether Ankara has changed its strategy in regards with Syria. What is clear for Turkey is that fighting or defeating the Kurdish militants cannot guarantee its security. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Gas bills in Italy will likely double in cost from October the 1st if gas prices continue to rise this way. The recent announcement by power regulator ARERA has gone utterly unnoticed, with the Italian media focusing on the electoral campaign about a month away from the September 25 national elections. A week ago, the outgoing Italian government unveiled a 17 billion euros aid package aimed at protecting families from surging energy costs and rising consumer prices. However, ARERA and some energy experts have warned that very little has been done so far to reduce energy consumption in the country.
Italy's highly critical energy situation has been downplayed by politicians and the media. On one side, there is confidence about the country achieving its target of reaching storage levels of 90%, while on the other side, the risk that Russia could altogether stop the flow of gas to Italy has been underplayed.
Gas is central to Italy's energy systems. The country even produces over 50% of its electricity from natural gas. Rome has cut its reliance on Russian gas imports to 25% from about 40% at the start of the year, a decision that has thrown the energy sector into uncertainty. Some analysts have predicted annual gas bills could reach an average of 1,800 euros next year, almost double the annual average of 950 euros recorded this year. Many Italians are simply bewildered about how they can find themselves in a position of not being able to heat or light their homes.
It's been this way forever. I used to be a unionist. I saw the crisis coming. This is how our country works. We don't have any sovereignty.
Nothing works in this country. We have forever been in the hands of a bunch of swindlers and criminals. Italy has no future.
The outgoing government is planning to offset its dependence on Russian gas by signing new deals with African and Eastern Mediterranean countries and building new regasification plants in a number of Italian sea towns, a move that has met with staunch opposition from local residents. Max Civili, Rome.
Rights groups have accused the Israeli regime of committing war crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip during its three-day onslaught against the territory. On Friday, Israeli forces started launching wanton attacks on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of civilians, including women and children. The fighting stopped on Sunday through an Egypt-mediated ceasefire, but Palestinians now have to live with the devastating aftermath of Israeli attacks. According to Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians were systematic and deliberate and fall under Israel's strategy of using disproportionate and excessive force against civilians.
Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reiterates its strongest condemnation of Israel's gross and systematic violations of international law, particularly in cases of extrajudicial killings and attacks against civilians and civilian objects. Such violations amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity for which those responsible must be held accountable.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008. The regime has been using U.S.-made warplanes and weapons to hit targets in the densely populated area.
The United States and Israel are both responsible for the bloodshed in Gaza. Israel was given the green light from the United States to carry out the brutal attacks on Gaza under the watchful eye of the international community. Israel and the United States are partners in crime against the Palestinian people.
Human rights organizations say, based on the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, it is more than clear that Israel has been committing war crimes during its attacks on Gaza.
The impunity Israel continues to enjoy and the absence of accountability encourage Israeli officials to continue perpetuating war crimes against Palestinians. As evidenced by its latest aggression on Gaza, Israel does not hesitate to engage in prohibited acts of killing, including direct targeting of civilians. The International Criminal Court must at least investigate these crimes.
For decades now, there has been no pressure on Israel to stop its violence against civilians. Despite repeated and desperate pleas from human rights groups, the international community has stayed silent about the regime's atrocities against Palestinians.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Now, rights groups are demanding that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Tragedy, injustice, and destruction prompted a group of London rights organizations to call an emergency demonstration in support of Palestine and Palestinians. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza was the worst it's been since the May 2021 war that killed 260 Palestinians and destroyed thousands of homes and businesses. This new assault cost the lives of at least 47 Palestinians. A third of the scores killed were children. For those attending the demonstration opposite Downing Street, the official residence of the British Prime Minister, they needed to be present to raise their voice against the injustice.
What we've witnessed over the last few days is very familiar, but no less horrific. Once again, Israel has been bombing the Palestinian people in Gaza, claiming a right to self-defense. There's a reality here that any form of violence that is used to enforce occupation, used to enforce apartheid, used to enforce settler colonialism is by definition illegitimate. It is the Palestinian people who have a right to defense and to protect themselves.
One of the main themes linking the speakers at this event is the fact that the Israeli aggression is only made possible by the tacit support of states like the British, and that Palestinian blood remains on British hands.
The UK has obligations under international humanitarian law and the Geneva Convention to look after the people who are occupied rather than stand with the oppressor, with the world's 21st century apartheid state. They must stop, they must support the Palestinians in real terms, not through words, two-state solution, which means absolutely nothing, but in sanctioning Israel, because that's the next thing that needs to happen.
Your policy on the Palestinians has to change. Justice has to prevail. And the way the hypocrisy, the way they do deal with the Palestinian issue and other issues like the Ukrainian issues, for example, is at least, we can say, a hypocritical way of dealing with it. Therefore, we are here today to raise our voice and tell them that this is not acceptable.
Though a ceasefire is supposed to be in force, commentators point out that this simply means Israel has moved its campaign of aggression to other parts of occupied Palestine, including Nablus, where there have already been casualties, raising the specter of an escalation resulting in further Palestinian blood being shed. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference on the dire situation of Yemeni children amid the years-long Saudi war on the country. The ministry has criticized the United Nations for its inaction on Saudi atrocities.
When the United Nations removed Saudi Arabia from the list of violators of children's rights, it encouraged the kingdom to continue killing Yemeni children and targeting service facilities for children such as schools, hospitals and health centers. It also prevented the entry of humanitarian and medical aid for children. We know that there are UN reports that talk about the spread of malnutrition amongst children, along with many chronic diseases that need care. But unfortunately, there is no real action to save the children of Yemen.
Officials say the UN has collaborated with the Saudi led coalition in killing Yemeni children by providing political cover up for Riyadh's violations. Moreover, the world body removed the kingdom from the list of groups accused of violating children's rights.
The United Nations is a clear and prominent partner in the aggressive war on Yemen, and we have in the 8 years of war clear evidence that the United Nations participated in all the crimes committed against the Yemenis and did not condemn Saudi Arabia for its crimes, but rather the victims bear everything the executioner does. The United Nations has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children through its silence and coverage of Saudi crimes. It has also removed Saudi Arabia 5 times from the list of violators of children's rights.
According to human rights groups, more than 9,000 children have been killed or maimed by Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war in 2015. Health officials say more than 1 million children are suffering from malnutrition, one of the highest numbers in the world.
Human rights activists say the United Nations is hostage to Saudi Arabia's funding for its programs. They say the world body has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children because of its silence on Saudi crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where al-Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nablusi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been warring Israeli military. They carried out a number of shooting against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian.
It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim al-Nablusi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
We never cease to support our Palestinian brothers and sisters. Why are the world rights entities keeping mum while Israel continues to kill innocent people in Gaza?
Tensions have escalated between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Friday, when Israel carried out airstrikes on cities across the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, killing dozens of people, including two commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. The Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, responded by firing hundreds of rockets towards Israel, putting the Israeli forces on the back foot. Activists here say the Islamic Jihad's show of force has pushed Tel Aviv into calling for a ceasefire, which took effect on Sunday.
In the past, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians would go unanswered. But today, as soon as Israel carries out a strike, the resistance responds immediately with its rockets. So, the era of hit and run is over.
The conflict is the worst outbreak of violence between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Operation Sword al-Quds, an 11-day war last May. The UN Security Council has expressed deep concern over the situation in the Gaza Strip during an emergency meeting held on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli aggression on the besieged territory.
While the UN has expressed its concern over the escalating violence against Palestinians, activists here say this is not enough. They called on the international body to stop paying lip service and take action to keep Israel from further violation of security in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis from all walks of life flocked to the street of Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the third Imam of Shia Muslims, Imam Hussein. He was martyred on Ashura, the 10th day of the lunar month of Muharram.
We went out as Yemenis to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who inspired patience and steadfastness in us in the face of the forces of global arrogance. We are in a battle with thousands of people like Yazid and even worse than him, including America and Israel. They attacked the Yemenis people and the Palestinian people. They are still killing our women and children. So this memory gives us hope that the values we learned from Imam Hussein will make us live generously and win at the end of the battle.
Imam Hussein, protesters said, is still alive because of his immortalized values and beliefs, which reject the oppression and corruption that Yemenis are currently experiencing. They further said Imam Hussein was the symbol of revolution and tenacity, who motivated Yemenis to resist the Saudi-led attack on their country.
This day is very important to us as we consider Ashura part of our identity. We are with Imam Hussein with our souls. Ashura this year coincides with the battle with the Zionist enemy, so the nation will follow the path of Imam Hussein in his jihad until the liberation of all occupied lands, especially occupied al-Quds, and Yemen has come a long way towards freedom and independence.
After refusing to pledge alliance to the tyrant of that day, Yazid, in 680 AD, Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions and family members were killed during the Battle of Karbala.
People here believe that Yemen has become a modern-day Karbala, with the Saudi-led coalition killing people, displacing civilians, and enforcing a siege on the country. People here are confident that Yemen's fight against the enemy will ultimately lead to victory. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
For a septuagenarian lawmakers who wrote the historic climate bill that Congress passed on Friday, 12th of August, and a 79-year-old president who is about to sign it into law, the measure represents a once-in-a-generation victory. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Lisa Friedman and Coral Davenport. The piece is titled, As Historic Climate Bill Heads to Biden's Desk, Young Activists Demand More. For the septuagenarian lawmakers who wrote the historic climate bill that Congress passed on Friday, 12th of August, and a 79-year-old president who is about to sign it into law, the measure represents a once-in-a-generation victory. But younger Democrats and climate activists crave more. They look at the bill as a down payment, and they worry a complacent electorate will believe Washington has at least solved climate change, when in fact scientists warn it has only taken the first necessary steps. This bill is not the bill that my generation deserves and needs to fully avert climate catastrophe, but it is the one that we can pass given how much power we have at this moment, said Barshini Prakash, a 29-year-old who co-founded the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led climate activism group. Christina Zintzun Ramirez, a 40-year-old president of Next Gen America, which is focused on young voter participation, said it wasn't lost on her that the climate deal was crafted largely by older men and included some concessions to the fossil fuel industry. We are very clear that it took so long because our Congress and our Senate doesn't look like the American people, said Ms. Ramirez, whose group is working to elect more young progressives committed to attacking global warming. The climate crisis is going to unfold on the majority of young people. Most of these congressional representatives will be dead by the time we face the consequences of their actions or of their inaction. In a letter to members of Congress, Ms. Ramirez and about 50 other young leaders told lawmakers, "Your work is not finished." The House of Representatives voted 220 to 207 on Friday, 12th of August, to approve the Inflation Reduction Act, with Democrats pushing past united Republican opposition. It was a replay of earlier this week, when Democrats in the Senate passed the bill without a single Republican vote. The legislation provides $370 billion over a decade for investments in wind, solar, and clean hydrogen, energy storage, and other measures designed to shift the American economy away from fossil fuels that have underpinned it for more than a century. Analysts estimate that the new law will draw down the United States' carbon dioxide emissions to the lowest level since Lyndon B. Johnson was president, 20% below 2005 levels by the end of this decade, on top of another 20% cut that will come as a result of market forces already in place. Together, that would eliminate an estimated 1 billion tons of pollution per year by the end of 2030, almost enough to meet Joe Biden's pledge to cut emissions 50% by 2030. Senator Patrick Leahy, an 82-year-old Democrat of Vermont, praised the legislation when it passed the Senate as a once-in-a-generation bill to meaningfully address the real threats of climate change, a characterization echoed by several of his colleagues. But scientists are saying the United States needs to do a lot more. It must stop adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by 2050, which the bill won't achieve. That is the target all major economies must meet to constrain average global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels, according to scientists. Beyond that threshold, the likelihood increases significantly of catastrophic droughts, catastrophic floods, wildfires, and heat waves. The planet has already warmed an average of about 1.1 degrees Celsius. It's like losing 20 pounds when you need to lose 100 pounds, said Robert McNally, the president of Rapidan Energy Group, an energy consulting firm. Robert McNally added, and this won't get you there. After the champagne is drunk, there will be a moment of sobriety, he said. How do you close the rest of that gap? To reach its 2030 goal, President Biden would still have to impose new regulations on emissions from power plants, vehicle tailpipes, and methane leaks from oil and gas wells. State and local governments would have to set new standards to compel the rapid adoption of electric cars, wind and solar-powered electricity, and energy-efficient buildings to make up the last percentage points. With a far heavier lift, essentially eliminating the nation's fossil fuel emissions in the next two decades, Congress would need to enact even more ambitious legislation than the historic bill just passed by a razor-thin majority, according to experts. To zero out emissions by 2050, Congress would have to take on politically difficult burden of taxing, penalizing, banning, or phasing out the coal, oil, and gas pollution that is driving global warming. It will be necessary for Congress to put sticks in place, said Dallas Bertrow, an energy policy expert at Resources for the Future, a nonpartisan energy and environmental research organization based in Washington, D.C. The new law buys Congress some time to act, Dallas Bertrow said. It doesn't need to happen today or tomorrow or this year or next year, he said, but it does have to happen before the end of this decade. Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, a 56-year-old who leads the House Progressives Caucus, said in addition to deeper cuts in emissions, young and racially diverse climate advocates want new provisions that also protect low-income neighborhoods and communities of color, which are disproportionately affected by climate impacts. They're really talking about it from this integrated perspective of jobs, justice, and decarbonization, she said. Representative Sean Caston, Democrat of Illinois and a scientist who owned a clean energy company, said Democrats and activists deserve an end zone dance after the bill is signed and then must get back to work. In the near term, Congress will have to make it easier to build the transmission lines and other facilities needed to allow the explosion of solar, wind, and other renewable energy promised by the new law, he said. Sean Caston, a 50-year-old, also wants Congress to eliminate tax breaks and other subsidies granted to the oil, gas, and coal industries, a move, he said, will trigger markets to correctly allocate capital to clean energy industries. We have to be, as legislators, very clear-eyed that we are not going to be judged on whether we voted yes or no on this bill, he said. We're going to be judged on whether the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is lower or higher 10 years from now. Even as scientific evidence links climate change to extreme weather events that is causing death and destruction in the United States, opinion polls show that the American electorate is divided along partisan lines about the scale of the problem and what to do about it. A Pew survey published in July found a majority of Republicans and independents who lean Republican, about 82%, say Joe Biden's climate policies are hurting the country, while 79% of Democrats and those who lean to the left were broadly supportive of Biden's policies. But Republicans between the ages of 18 and 29 surveyed were more likely than older adults to say the federal government needs to act on climate change, and 64% wanted the government to require power companies to use more energy from renewable sources. And younger Americans of both political parties, those born after 1981, are more likely to be politically engaged on climate change than older generations, according to a 2021 Pew survey. Celinda Lake, a Democratic strategist, said she believes the political support for a carbon tax could grow, particularly as Millennial and Generation Z voters entered office. In 2024, the Millennials and younger generations will outnumber the Boomer voters, Celinda Lake said. She added, "These are the voters who vote on this issue. It mobilizes them. In the next 20 years, we will see a massive shift in the electorate towards people who want to save the planet." Wisconsin State Representative Greta Neubauer, a 30-year-old, led the rollout of a package of 22 climate bills this year, five of which she wrote. None received a hearing in the Republican-led legislature, much less a vote. But Ms. Neubauer says she still finds the number of former activists like herself now turning to politics encouraging. "When Donald Trump was elected, we all had to look around and recognize the failures of our movement," said Ms. Neubauer, who ran on a climate platform and was elected in 2017. Many of her fellow former activists have recently joined political campaigns or considered running for office themselves to take the fight off college campuses, she said. William Riley, who served as head of Environmental Protection Agency under President George H.W. Bush, said Democrats will be lucky to just maintain the new provisions that just barely got through the Congress. "As long as you've got a unanimous Republican position against it, they're going to have to fight just to keep what they've got in place," William Riley said. "They have to fight to keep the clean energy incentives, fight to keep any regulations, and Republicans will try to claw it back unless at some point enough Republicans feel that they are politically free to convert." Benji Becker, a 24-year-old founder of American Conservation Coalition, a conservative climate action group, said if Republicans retake either the House or Senate in November's midterm elections, he wants party leaders to address climate change. He noted that climate and tax bill includes incentives for nuclear power and other Republican priorities, including carbon capture technology that could allow coal or gas-burning power plants to keep operating with lower carbon emissions. Republicans can either go after that in the next Congress and champion the first-ever bipartisan climate bill, or they can stay where they've been for the last decade, Mr. Becker said. "My generation will be disappointed if they don't lead from the front." Rihanna Gunn-Wright, a 32-year-old director of climate policy at the Roosevelt Institute, a liberal think tank and an architect of the Green New Deal, said she is worried a sense of complacency will settle in after passage of this climate bill. "Over the next 7 or 8 years, there will still, unfortunately, be extreme weather events, and we'll still need to keep pointing out the cause of those events, carbon dioxide emissions. And from where? From fossil fuels," she said. Ms. Gunn-Wright said she knows activists who fought for decades to see a president sign major climate legislation will be tired. But she cautioned, in the United States, we have a history of taking a lot of first steps and then not taking the second step, the third or the fourth step.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear friends. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to Lantern. We have an interesting story. Horebn Yazid Riahi. Horebn Yazid was a carrier officer in the Kufa army. As a professional soldier, he did not very much concern himself with what he considered to be political issues. His duty, he felt, was to execute the order of his superiors. However, lurking somewhere in that stout military heart was an Islamic conscience. Horebn Yazid and his soldiers met Imam al-Hussein and his companions at a place a few miles outside Kufa. It was midday when the two parties met. Hor and his people had been traveling since morning and were very thirsty. He requested Imam al-Hussein for water for his army. Imam Hussein asked Hazrat Abbas and the others to give Hor and his men water and also to give water to their horses. This must have been a poignant scene. Water bottles being brought out of the saddle bags and the youth pouring water for Yazid's army to quench their thirst. Zuhr prayer, well led by Imam and Hor and his soldiers, joined in. After the prayers, Hor told Imam al-Hussein that his orders were to stop Imam al-Hussein from going to Kufa unless he agreed to give bay'ah, that means swear allegiance, to Yazid. Imam al-Hussein said that he would never give bay'ah to Yazid. Imam Hussein could have fought Hor and his soldiers and forced his way into Kufa, but he did not wish to start any battle. He told Hor that he would take another route and go away from Kufa. Hor said that his orders were to follow Imam al-Hussein and so followed by Hor and his 1,000 soldiers. Imam al-Hussein and his companions rode in the direction away from Kufa. On the 2nd of Muharram, they reached Karbala. Imam Hussein bowed lander and put up his tents. Hor and his men pitched these camps some distance away. The following day, Umar ibn Sa'd came to Karbala with 4,000 soldiers. On the night of Ashura, Hor was very restless. He could hear the children in Imam al-Hussein's camp cry because of thirst. He began to think, "What have I done? Why did I put the son of Fatima in this position?" Hor, his son, and his slave rode over to Imam al-Hussein's camp. Hor threw himself at Imam al-Hussein's feet, pleading for his forgiveness. Imam Hussein took Hor in his arms and said, "Hor, I forgive you. I assure you that my grandfather, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, also forgives you." Hor then asked Imam al-Hussein for permission to go and fight the enemies of Islam. Imam Hussein said, "Hor, you are my guest. How can I let you die for me?" Hor insisted. Hor went to the battlefield, and after a valiant fight, he fell and was killed. His son and his slave were also killed. Dear brothers and sisters, accept our sorrow and condolences on the month of Muharram. I invite you to listen to the continuation of this program, Lantern. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa binastain. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with certain aspects of the life and times of Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. In the beginning, it must be indicated that Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi was a prominent figure and personality in the city of Al-Kufa. Initially, he was attached to the governing system, that is the Umayyad hegemony in Al-Kufa. I mean, at that time, great people or dignitaries of a city were expected to be attached to the governing body or governing system or hegemony. And Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi was no exception in this regard. However, Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi was a person who, religiously speaking, believed in the cause of Imam al-Husayn al-Islam and in the pure Islam as represented in Shi'ism. We find that in the beginning, Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi intercepted Imam al-Husayn al-Islam in the vicinity of Al-Kufa and prevented him from reaching Al-Kufa because Imam al-Husayn al-Salam had received around 12,000 letters of invitation from the people of Al-Kufa and translated into present-day political idiom. Those 12,000 letters of invitation meant a large landslide in terms of political campaign. So Imam al-Husayn al-Salam felt it, religiously speaking, necessary and incumbent on himself to answer the call of those people. However, on the way from Mecca to Al-Kufa, Imam al-Husayn al-Salam was intercepted by al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi and the small army under him. And this caused Imam al-Husayn al-Salam to divert his itinerary and to go somewhere else. Well, al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi didn't want to start any combat or any military clash against Imam al-Husayn al-Salam. And one of the reasons is that when it was time for Salat, Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi stood behind Imam al-Husayn al-Salam and prayed behind Imam al-Husayn al-Salam. And it means that, religiously speaking, he believed in Imam al-Husayn al-Salam. However, politically speaking, he was still attached to the Umayyad government and hegemony.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Well, in a conversation with Imam al-Husayn al-Salam, Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi intended to threaten Imam al-Husayn al-Salam, and when he received a harsh feedback and answer, and in fact a very severe setback of Imam al-Husayn al-Salam, in which Imam al-Husayn al-Salam mentioned and made reference to Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi's mother, Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi never answered anything. I mean, he swallowed his anger and expressed that he wouldn't say anything because Imam al-Husayn al-Salam's mother was none but Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salamullah alayha. Because Imam al-Husayn al-Salam noticed that Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi paid respect to Imam al-Hussein's mother, that is, Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salamullah alayha, we find that the attitude of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam toward al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi changed, and Imam al-Hussein al-Salam never initiated any war against al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi and the army under his command. This is because of two reasons. First of all, Imam al-Hussein al-Salam was the Imam of peace and peacemaking, and he was never the Imam of initiating any war. This is one. And the second reason is that Imam al-Hussein al-Salam realized that al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi was a believer. Religiously speaking, he was a believer. However, from the point of his formal obligations and commitment, he was still on the side of the Umayyads. Several days passed by in this way until it was the day of Ashura. When it was on the day of Ashura in the morning, al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi realized that it wasn't just a military maneuver or a kind of military showing off, or rather it was going to be a very harsh military clash between the two camps. And he noticed that Umar ibn Sa'd initiated the war and shot the first arrow toward the camp of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam. When al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi understood that in that battle, the Umayyad side, more than in 30,000 soldiers would certainly martyr whoever would be on the way in the camp of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam, al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi realized that any moment he would spend with the Umayyad camp would certainly be regarded as his big crime. Not big sin, but big crime. Because of this, al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi left the files and ranks of the Umayyad camp, where he was a commander, and joined Imam al-Hussein al-Salam as a simple servant and as a simple soldier.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.